positing things. So in order to get to non-dualism, we'll have to define dualism and then cross it off.
One of the things that puzzled me is you drew a circle, mm-hmm. and you said there's inside and outside the circle. Rub it out, we're not interested, and there's nothing left, then, is there?
Yes, there is. Paper.
Oh, yes. So, that's one. Isn't it?
One? No, it isn't. Let's have a look. If I want to represent one, I'll use the word one. Look. O-N-E. Now, this already is one, before I put the N and the E on it, is one circle. When we're talking about concepts of oneness, of unity, we must circumscribe. If I imagine this paper extended infinitely, it is not a unity. It isn't a one. It's not two. It's nothing. So, when I circumscribe a zone, I am create. This is the root kara. Read it, Hebraica, and it is arc. Here's an arc. We tend to think of this as an arc, but really the whole thing is an arc. This is Noah's arc. Noah is the noetic principle, noosed intelligence. The white paper is Noah. This is Noah's Ark. This is the first principle, necessarily unific, of definition. To define is to indicate the limits, the fin, in definition. O is already a unity because it circumscribes a zone. The zone it circumscribes internally is finite. The one excluded isn't one, it's infinite. We cannot use the concept of unity unless we finite. Now, supposing we take this O and say that O represents all there is. We've said all there is, and is part of the verb to be. The Hebrew letter B is a house. It's a nomadic house. This is the ground, this is the wall of the tent, and that's the roof. And there's Abraham and our son on the ground. The wind is blowing this way. That is their version of the letter B. Now, B is pronounced by closing the mouth, as if you were about to say M, and then exploding it. You pile up the air behind it, voice it, and then blow it out suddenly, B. Before you let it out, it is already B, not articulated. When you let it fly out, at that moment, people know what you said, namely B. It is voiced. It signifies a boundary because the mouth is closed in order to pronounce it. If we take the Sanskrit Om, this M can only be pronounced with a closed mouth. And it isn't a plosive. If we make it into a plosive, we explode it. It becomes OMB. Start to pronounce OM. Pile an air behind it and let it out suddenly. It's OB. In Greek, if we wanted to represent B, we'd write MP. In modern Greek. Because P is the same plosive unvoiced with the M humming on it. Becomes B. But it is a closure. So the verb to be implies finiting. That's B for boundary, B for being. The idea of the part of the verb to be called is, that present tense, is the same as the word yes. Is, you see, is in Israel. Yes. Israel means the affirmation of the rulership of God. Is, we know because of stimulation. There is a being. Does that being know that there is another being? The answer is, does a stimulus come from another being? There is a being, and here is I-S, the stimulus, produces a reverberation in this being. this being now says there is, that is, issuing power, stimulus source outside myself. We don't say I is unless they're very black in the face. We say I am. Am means substantial energies. I feel my substance. I know there is another being, there is another being, because the stimulus comes from outside. So the unity principle is circumscription. So if I get a piece of paper, put a circle on it and then rub it out, I put the circle on it in order to give you a concept of unity. And then I ask you to rub it out so that you will have what there was before the unity was put down. Now before I posit Paul Sid, Paul is the same Paul in power and poetry and so on, it means itself, this positing of a zone, the power. Paul Sid means to make power sit and therefore to produce a locus of action. Before I posit anything whatever, there is that in which I'm going to posit it. That is consciousness. So the white paper represents consciousness. Before I draw on it, there is no thing. Thing is finite. We put a finite, we rub it out, what remains is consciousness. Then we have consciousness without an object. And this is the aim of all yoga, to get hold of consciousness without an object. To get it, we must posit the object clearly and then rub it out. Now most people cannot posit an object in the mind clearly, and therefore they cannot rub it out. In order to rub out an idea, you must first become aware that you have an idea and then rub it out. The definition, the Patanjali definition of yoga is the suppression of the modifications of the mind. It simply means rub out what is in and restore the original consciousness. Now we mustn't use the word unity because of the T in it. We mustn't use the word oneness because of the O in it to symbolize that which is infinite. The infinite is the not finite. So we're not allowed to make a mark to represent the infinite. So if I want to represent the infinite and make a mark, I will do this. There's a finite. Here's half of one, and there's the other half unrepresented. That's the sign of Taurus. It tells us, if we look at it, that a force from the infinite and the non-defined enters, rotates, and leaves. That's what the sign of Taurus means. This top part is the sign of the ram, made naturalistically like this to cool people. It's really the semicircle, indicating the other half, which you haven't drawn, the infinite. Notice that the two halves, finite and infinite, are not equal. One is finite, the visible one here, the other one is infinite. And nevertheless, it's a true opposition, finite, infinite. This is a finite, this is half a finite, where's the other half? This is an indicator to the mind. It imparts a direction to the mind, so the mind can know in which direction to look for its content. The content of the mind above there is nothing. It is not calm. It is not tent. This tent is tenere, to hold. There is nothing held. It is beyond the concept of holding. If we want to make a hold, we must make a holder. Now, there's the tent, the holding. If we put a box inside there and then rub this out, we can't say that the box is held in the circle that we've rubbed out. But if we define the white paper as consciousness, white is the equilibration of all colours, consciousness is the equilibration of all possibilities, whatever. So if we define the box as internal, we must circumscribe around it. To have a withinness, we must have a surrounding. So we can only use the concept of unity, of oneness, any monistic concept at all, by making a finite. Some of the mystics have been thoroughly aware of this when they have said anyone who thinks God is infinite is misunderstanding God. What they mean to say is that the object of worship is an object, object means thrown, that of is thrown into consciousness and is then worshipped. But if it is an object, it is finite. And therefore, theologically, when we talk about God as an object of worship, we cannot be talking about the Godhead theologically. We're talking about God. Now, God we can represent, there's God. God is a circle, and that is the identity of the Logos of the Gospel of John with God. There's the Son, the Logos. In the beginning was the Word. There it is, the principle of order. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, in the Gospel of John, it uses the article, and it doesn't use it with the word Logos. So you have Hologos, the Word, and Logos without the article. One refers to outside, which is the plain consciousness, prior to the positing of Logos form. But that consciousness is itself that which precipitated that form. So the form is made as an object thrown in, so that some beings, not yet self-conscious and reflexive, will have something to focus on. God is an object to help people who are not infinite in consciousness and who need something to measure. Fear, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. Fear is a continuous scattering. The word means scattering. When the forms in the mind continuously scatter, you feel insecure. Now, if you want to assure yourself, is it I, me, two S's, sure. I'm yes, sure, you see. I measure. The measuring is necessarily formal. We must have a circumscribed zone, and we must take its diameter, and so on, in order to determine the relations within it. If we have this vague, wandering flux, the Ahasuerus, the wandering Jew, it won't do. If we put down this form and then measure it, we become assured. Measure means me assured.
But there has, in this idea, been a definite shift, haven't there, though? I mean, on the integration principle, you're on this concept. But when you've rubbed it out, you're not on it, are you?
You don't need it.
You don't need it.
Once you've realised that you can measure if you will to, you don't will to. The measuring is only to give you security. You assure yourself when you measure. Remember that the soul is the causal. Ideas are the subtle and your physical body is the gross. We want to get at the cause.
We're going to go down to the back.
Let's restate this again. Causal, soul, subtle, mind, idea. Mind is counting, and therefore form. Gross. His bum. That's a nice word. Now, the causal is the soul, and it is absolutely formless. Because it is formless, when it looks inside itself, it finds no thing. Finding no thing, because it is causal, it starts to create. Now, we said we use the word spirit. Notice the peer in it, fire. And we represent it like that. Tip of the horns. We turn it round and call this soul. That is the soul. The soul is simply spirit rotated. It's that that makes it solo, an individuated being. If we talk about the world soul, we're talking about sentiency up to the biggest circumscription we can imagine. This spirit made the circumscription, this boundary. It so loved the world, as the Bible says, God, the Father, so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. And that principle of the cross there, extended down here, is the gross body. The gross body is simply forces intersecting, electronic or whatever other forces you care to call it. Spirit, soul, body. That is the sign of Mercury, the Messiah. This one is to remind us of the undefined. It's like the top brick on the pyramid, which was never put on. I put it on, I should know that. That's to remind you that it hasn't been put on. That top brick that isn't on the Great Pyramid is represented by the horns. Here is the soul. That soul, when it is new, that is on the first rotation of spirit, seeks a body. That is, it starts to inform itself. If we say this is Adam, this is God the Father, and Adam is told to develop himself, to multiply, to become fruitful, and so on. And inside Adam is form. But it isn't very, very easy to develop form inside yourself without an external stimulus to strike on you. Let's say here's Adam. He knew he was finite because he could feel forces acting upon him. Inside him was a very faint principle of spirit, active, passive. Outside was a force of nature, travelling through and obscuring progressively that form of the active, passive spirit. So he could not generate from himself and said to God, give me a helpmeet. And God paraded all the animals before Adam, and Adam did not find the helpmeet. And then God caused a sleep to go to Adam and took out of Adam the form that he hadn't been able to actualize by his own efforts. And then the stimulus comes again, hits on here, and it travels right through, and Adam is then identifying with the external world. That is the form. So the process of informing, putting the form in Adam, which he did not do immediately by act of will, which he could have done, was then to be developed through the time process in relation with nature, which is the serpent. So the serpent will bite at the heel. The heel is the hind part, the physical body. That physical body will bruise the serpent's head. Nature will be continuously acted upon by man and will continuously act on man. There's our unity concept. All these we can insert inside. The white paper is spirit. Let's draw an imaginary pair of horns there. Can you see them? And the other half. Well, ignore the part that we drew there invisibly and concentrate on the other half. Extend it infinitely. That is spirit. It is not a one. But it came in and went like that and made a one. In the act of doing it, it has circumscribed its zone. And because the essential quality of the essence represented by that paper, that is rippling inside. And the ripples inside are beating against the boundary set up. So it is becoming informed. Now, it's never only one such soul, we'll say the macrocosmic soul, then it would develop inside itself by its own efforts, necessarily, because there would be nothing outside to stimulate it. But understanding non-dualism is this. We want to put down O for any monistic concept ever, any unity principle, any philosophy of monism, any religion which postulates that there is a God which is other than the worshipper, and that the worshipper must see as an object to itself. There is the universe, here is a man kneeling down with his hands up.
Is worshipping.
Kneeling on a diameter, keeping comfortable. He's worshipping this macrocosmic being. And he is saying, in him, look at two worshippers, we live, move, and have our being. In implies that circumscription. So when these two beings say, in him, we live, move, and have our being, and yet they say, we are not God, we are just worshippers. And they postulate the one God, and themselves as other than it, they are dualists. So, if we want to get at something better than that, we will have to put down the worshippers and the one God and cross them off. We can easily do it logically, because if we have an entity and another entity, and these two entities have nothing whatever in common, there is no relation possible. So if that one represents a worshipper, and that one represents God, and they're absolutely dissimilar, the worshipper is wasting his time worshipping the God, because the God can do nothing for him, because the God can't act upon him, because they're absolutely dissimilar. So if there's any sense in a worshipper worshipping a God, there must be something in them identical. That thing which is identical is the ground of the relation. And if that is two, the God and the worshipper, that ground, here represented by the white paper, is not two. Neither is it one, because we're not circumscribing it. So when we say non-dual, we do not mean non-monistic. We mean non-dual. We're simply negating the concept of duality. There's a worshipper, there's the worship. If there's any sense in worship at all, it can only be that there's an identity between the two. God is a concept in the mind of the worshipper. The worshipper is a concept in the mind of God. Because God is the creator, creates internal to himself a worshipper, so that the man is in the image of the God. The image is the I make, the will to individuation. So inside there's God, and he puts an image. That image is inside God. In the image of God, the appetite of God, the will of God, the man appears and proceeds to worship. There is a duality. And in it, there's an unpassable hiatus between the two. Because they have no similarity whatever, unless we postulate that we've written them on the white paper which represents the ground of both. When Christ says, I and my Father are one, he's talking about this. And at the same time, when he's talking about the differences between himself and the Father, he says, two witnesses establish the truth. I am one and my Father is the other. So he makes two out of one. And yet, there's an absolute identity between the paper inside the circle and outside it. Christ defines God. God is a spirit. That spirit blows where it lists. No man knows where it came from, where it goes to. It is not locatable, therefore it is not circumscribed. He's talking about the absolute spirit, and that absolute spirit is the ground of the relation between observer and observed, worshipper and worshipped. So, if we want to get the benefit of it, we have to understand this non-dualism. If a man prays to God, it is because that man is already God and doesn't know it. For instance, in Advaitism, if a man says, I do not have faith in myself, they say he is an atheist. Because his self, capital S, is God. When Christ says, if you go to the Father, that's the white paper, greater works than these shall you do, he meant it. The particular works that he did at that time were little works demanded by a little people. They didn't want very big miracles. They wanted those that were startling to them. Today, a jet plane would startle. In those days, the miracles were quite small. Just a little healing there, or somebody with a psychological disorder here, or somebody with a physical disorder there. And all well within the reach of the mind of those people. Therefore, he said, greater works than these shall you do if you go to the Father. We have the concept of oneness. We must always remember that it means finite in its own. If we say not one and cross it off, we simply negated the concept one. If we put two down, worshipper and worshipped, and then say the common substratum upon which we made the marks to symbolize the two is the paper, which symbolizes the absolute intelligence which projects God and the worshipper, which is God and the worshipper. These symbolize activities in the mind. The mind actually runs around that circle to make itself aware that there is such, and it goes vertical and horizontal and the intersection point to understand the active and the passive. The mind has the capacity for moving in this way because it is a material. Motion only relates to that which is finitable. The infinite doesn't need to move anywhere because it is already infinitely extended. There is nowhere where it is not. So let us clearly understand that non-dualism is deliberately postulating God and the worshipper and then denying their duality. He denies their separateness. So that in effect, when a man with a body says, I will pray to God, as a matter of fact, physically this man folds his hands up and talks to a concept in his head of God. He doesn't talk to anything else. He has a concept of God in his head. Either that concept in his head corresponds or not with some reality. If it doesn't, he's wasting his time. But if it does correspond with the reality, he is not wasting his time, because his concept is the mediating factor between himself and the reality that it signifies. So here is the concept, and for an ordinary person praying, the tendency is, although if you ask him he will deny it, the tendency is that when he prays he thinks somewhere far away from himself, and he prays to a God. He does not pray at his own center. He prays to a God, believing that God to be other than his own self. That is dualism. If dualism is true, he's wasting his time. But in fact, every man, as we saw last week, derives from a primary cosmic egg, which by a process of division within it has produced a universe with solar systems, planets, nations and so on, families, individuals, all within it. If he knows that, then when this man climbs up into his concept, he's doing exactly the same thing in himself as if he were to travel back in time to his first ancestor. Only we know that the germplasm in a human being is identical today with what it was in Adam and whatever beings Adam derived from. The germplasm is continuous from generation to generation. So through the germplasm we can now get at the original plasm, the original modelable substance. And that is what we do in prayer. In prayer, we set up this concept deliberately, and we understand the concept to be that I, the observer, am not at odds with that absolute intelligence. And in so doing, when you pray in that manner, with due regard for the beings praying to the contrary, when you pray in that manner for that which this absolute consciousness is moving towards accomplishing, what you really do is remove the barriers that were in the individual self, and the absolute then comes in and accomplishes that thing because it was already striving to do it. So Christ says, what I see the Father do in secret, that I do openly. As an individual, if I see the purpose of the absolute manifesting, striving to express itself, and I deliberately go in that direction, I have the backing of the absolute. Hitler, when he wanted to lead the Germans, studied German mythology, German folklore, and so on. He found out where the Germans were trying to go, then he got in front of them, walking in their direction, and they thought he was a leader, because he was walking in front. Now, he actually stated that openly, that he had studied the German mythology, found out where they wanted to go. That was the Father working through the German. Then said, behold, I am in front of you, I must be the leader. And having become the Führer in that manner, they thought they were following him. And they are always seeking expression, articulation. They want somebody to say where they're going because they're a bit vague. So the person who articulates where everybody is going and gets in front of them appears to be a leader. But if he didn't see where the Father, the generative force behind every nation, is going, there wouldn't be any in front to get him to. So non-dualism means that we have to be quite clear what dualism means, namely a severance between the worshipper and the worshipped, between man and God. See just what it means, that severance, and then rub it out. There are many, many things we cannot understand unless we first set up an erroneous idea, clarify it, and then rub it out. The erroneous idea behind dualism is this. If there be two entities with nothing whatever in common, they cannot act upon each other. It is logically impossible. Therefore, if there are two entities called God and worshipper, and if there is any use whatever in a worshipper worshipping that God, they cannot be absolutely different. And where they are not absolutely different, they are the same. And where they are the same, the worshipper is worshipping himself. And yet he's identified with this paper, with infinity. He's not identified with the one, because he's gone behind God and the worshipper to the undefined, the formless absolute, and asserted that that is what he is. In the Hindu metaphysics, it is stated, that thou art that. It isn't given a name other than that. That the word is back to the same as the English word that. You remove the H from the English word tap. It's the same thing. The same thing is taught to the Egyptians. And it implies T. And an energy between. Now there's that. There must be two intersection places or forces with an energy flow between before you can say that. Because to say that as opposed to this is to assert there is something outside yourself. When you say this, you are affirming in yourself. When you say that, you are throwing it out, objectifying it. So, what is being referred to in the word that is one being, another being, the energy flow between. So, that thou art. That is, this consciousness has within it the forms which make dualism possible, plus the energy flow between them which denies the duality. You can understand why Shankara is credited with a concept so big that the Brahmins considered it was a waste of time trying to teach people non-dualism. They said they will never understand it, and some true, they could understand it if they applied themselves to it over and over again. familiarise themselves with this idea of the dualism, then cross it out and retain the significance. If there is an ear and there is a mouth talking to it and there is a vibration, if this ear is able to interpret this vibration, it means that that ear is attached to a man with a mouth. Otherwise it cannot interpret. So there's an identity between the receiver and the giver. And the two are not two. So non-dualism represents the highest conceivable philosophy, because it first postulates all other philosophies and then rubs them out and says they are points of view. There are many ways of looking at the absolute. And a mole with its tangential eyes burrowing in the ground sees reality in a different way from the way a cuckoo sees it. But it's the same reality. A fly with a many-faceted eye doesn't see you like you see yourself when you look in a mirror. Whatever you are, you are. But a given organism will see you in a way conditioned by its own organism. So that all knowledge is conditioned by the vehicle whereby you gain it. And therefore all knowledges can be rubbed out, absolutely, because they are simply the modes in which finites react to an absolute stimulus. The purana of the yogi is the objective fact. This is the objective knowledge that Gurdjieff is talking about. The objective fact is that fact which consciousness perceives when there is no interference from a finite organism. If we take the quietest analysis, we did this a few weeks ago, we take this fact. Our minds are continuously working. The working of our mind is interfering with incoming stimuli. If we stop the mind working and allow the external stimulus to come to us, then whatever its character is will register in us unmodified. And that would be objective knowledge of the character of that stimulus, as opposed to subjective knowledge, where the stimulus coming towards us is interfered with by our own energy behavior. So, non-dualism is not really difficult to understand if you accept the subject, the predicate, the server and the ob. We said before that the subject, exhausted in all possible ways, is P to the end. All conceivable predications, whatever, add up to the subject, and that is the consciousness. The same subject is called observer when he serves of. The ob that he serves is necessarily a finite. So we don't call him the observer when he's not serving an ob. So we say, here is a server of ob. Over here is an eye, which is very introverted. It's like in the squint. The server of ob and the ob served are not the same. But this server of ob is simply that non-server of ob, consciousness, when it deliberately identifies with an ob who serves it. You can, if you like, attend to something or not. When your consciousness is standing without any motion whatever, it is not an observer. But when that same consciousness focuses, as when I put my eyes on the end of this prayer, at that moment I am serving ob, I am attending to that. And the crown is then conditioning my mental content, because I am serving it. If I hold it in front of my eye and look beyond it, I don't see it. If I like to concentrate on the wall, I can forget this completely. And in so doing, I am not serving this off. I'll be serving the walls off. That would be the object in consciousness. If I cross out the wall completely, and although my eyes are open, I am thinking about consciousness as such. I am not an observer. So I can either be a pure witness, which is serving nothing whatever, or a server of an object, or, as to my physical body, an object served. There again, the pure witness, the server of arm, and the object. Now we have to telescope these together, because spirit absolutely is all that is. The rotation of spirit that makes soul is already a first modification. And this causal to strike, means it has gone around and hit itself there, and in so doing, locked a zone up. Here is the gross. This gross, acting upon this, produces form inside it, the gross material stimulus. That form is then the subtle body. Now St. Paul says we are first made into a gross body, and then, here is the soul, that gross body acts upon the soul and produces a subtle body, which he calls a spiritual body. And if the formal stimulus from below is disorderly, then the soul will be disorderly. But we said before that inside Adam was a faint, subtle, very, very fine form, which is the absolute ripple of spirit, which is absolute omniscience. Whatever can be known in the time process in the body is eternally present in the spirit, because the spirit is pure dynamism. It is a perpetual flux of formal actuality which does not become known, locked up and made now known, unless it rotates. With the appearance of rotation, the time process comes. Time is the product of the rotation. Serialization is seeing the rotation on the rim, one thing after another. And then the physical body here is the reference point for measuring the time processes, the rotations of psychic energies. If we remove all the physical symbols from the mind, time ceases. Take away all serial presentation and it is timeless. Sometimes you may be reading a book, something in the book may stop your attention for a moment, and then your mind may stop. You're musing, in the sense that the Chinese would have used it, of a mountain being a mountain, because he's musing mountain. And the next time you look at the clock, you may find it's gone, a lot of time. And you didn't know about that lapse of time because you had no serial presentation. In the same way, you can wake up in the morning and then go to sleep again and think you've been asleep for an hour, look at the clock and find that you've only been asleep for 2 minutes. This is the reverse process. Again, something has happened. The mind's serial presentation of form has been interfered with. And when we remove serialization, there is no time. This is why in the Revelation it says, then there will be time no more. Because when the consciousness rises above the situation, serialization is seen as simultaneity. So if I draw a line with a series of marks on it, if you get very close to that line, you will have to count them one after the other. Let's say at your distance, you can see them without running along. They're simultaneous for you, but if I get a ladybird and force it to walk along that line by painting it with ladybird scent, the ladybird will come across these lines one after the other, and it will take ladybird time, when in fact you've seen it simultaneously. Now, with the absolute spirit, everything is simultaneous and therefore timeless. But with finites, internal to large rotations, there is always time above them. And the smaller the finite, the more it sees in the situation, the more time there is in it. And the multiplication of law within the spheres is also a multiplication of time. The idea that the biggest circle of all is only one law. Another circle inside there is another law. So there's one law, two laws, small circle, three laws, and so on. Because each rotation has its own speed. It takes about 25,000 years for the sun to pass through all the houses of the zodiac in the precession of the equinoxes. That's one cycle, but that's a very small cycle compared with some of them. We know something historically about a portion of that cycle, because we know that when Christ brought his dispensation, we were entering the sign of Pisces, and that every 2,160 years we shift a house. When we've gone around 12 times through 12 houses, we've got a large cycle. And in each period there is a dispensation. Something can be done easily, and everything else is difficult. And the same thing happens with a human being, echoing the macrocosmic evolution, because to a child something is easy, which later on will be difficult. And something is difficult for it, which later on will be easy. So there's a time for every particular thing, a favorable time. If we can get hold of that favorable time and use it, then we can develop. There's a tide in the affairs of men taking the flood, etc. And there is a time for gathering stones together, and a time for throwing stones away. To become aware of the function of each time is to become superior to the law which that time is. So in the non-dual concept we have all philosophies wrapped up and thrown away. What is then left is the causal, the soul. And it does not need the form that it has had and deliberately thrown away. Before the baby has form, it seeks form, because it appears to the baby that there is power in form. After a time, it discovers that there isn't power in that form, but the power appears to be in another form. So it keeps on acquiring new forms. The whole of civil life and the whole of civilization is built deliberately on a plan to impart form in the educational process, to stress form, to convince people that form is the supreme value. But form, when you've got it, has to be thrown away. And when you have got form, your top concept, you can afford to throw it away, because you know that it was will which generated the forms, and that the same will which generated them in its sphere doesn't need them, because if ever it becomes in need of them, it can recreate. So this has to do with the second death. Your physical body is a support for you during the period when you need external stimulation. When the external stimulation has given you a sufficient body of ideas, the subtle body, for you to work on, you do not need the external physical body. You give it up and it dies. Very few people are killed, most people die. They get fed up and they leave the body, they withdraw. And as they withdraw the energy, the organs begin to degenerate. And the more they degenerate, the more fed up the owner becomes, and then he leaves. And when he's left the physical body, that's the first death, he has a body of ideas. He works upon those ideas. Now, if he's got a very good body of well-integrated ideas, pure logic, something like Plotinus or Plato, Proclus, those people had, then he's got enough in the subtle body to work on, up to the point where he again becomes aware that he is a volitional being who can generate form wherever and whenever he wants it. At that point, he throws away that body of ideas. He's finished with it. He vacates it. That is the second leaving. But that body is so well integrated that it does not die. And the soul that leaves it is not hurt by leaving it. Therefore, it says, they shall not be hurt of the second death. But the body that has been deserted by that soul now is a reflexive self-conscious will. is so tremendously valuable to other souls with inferior integration of body that they all tend to scramble for that well-integrated body and try to get in it. So in the subtle world there's a general scramble. Now if you doubt that, you can find it in your own mind very, very easily, because if you look in your own mind you will discover that if you've got a good idea, one that promises you integration and power, that all the little ideas that you have are scrambling to get in it. And exactly as in the human being, the microcosm, so it is in the macrocosm. The big universe is full of subtle bodies inhabited by souls, not very well integrated bodies, and now and then somebody works very hard, integrates a body and then discards it, and all the other souls think that's a lovely body, I'll have that. And the same thing happens macrocosmically as microcosmically. So on Earth with human beings, if a man has got a well integrated idea, other people that are moving towards integration would like to get that idea, and they will work to get it. And it says, ye needs must love the highest when ye see it. Therefore, if you see this big concept that would put in order for you all your little concepts, you spontaneously move towards it. And what you are looking for is reflexive self-consciousness, where you are again at the point of absolute purity. You've eliminated all the empirical, fortuitous, accidental relations of form. You've attained the absolute logic, the cosmic logos. You can define any form from any point of the universe, and then you give it up. You are then a volitional being. Nobody could predict you. The spirit bloweth where it listeth. They may say, well, you know all the rules, you should conform to them. And the answer is, if you know all the rules, you may conform to them. But you don't have to. Because then you are a volitional being. Now, the volitional being is necessarily formless. It is not conditioned by form. It creates form when it needs it. So, because it has no form, because form is not essential to it, it is pure will, therefore there is no formal value in it. Therefore, if we say, let us equate this soul, which is reflexively self-conscious and volitional, with the term yogi, which the literal content means, then that being has no need whatever of form, does not act from form, can create form. And as form is the zone where values, goods and evils, are stated, he is above good and evil. Therefore it says the works of yogis are neither black nor white. Now in order to get at it, you have to go through the stages. A child at birth cannot say, someday I'm going to be mature, therefore I will skip all the intervening stages and become mature now. If that child were a new soul and tried to do that, it would be deficient in the memory of all the sufferings that other beings have to go through to become perfect. Now the whole purpose of the precipitation of the material world is precisely to force people through a very, very painful process of education which will eliminate from them all arrogance, all stupid egotism, and confer upon them compassion for another being's sufferings. The being that goes through life with no suffering is deficient, because he doesn't know what other beings are doing. So if you get a child and shelter it from sufferings, you don't allow it ever to pay the price of its own decision, it will grow up characterless. And when it's released into the world, it will have a very, very rough time, because it will know nothing about the world. So the prodigal son is indicated, and the affirmation of the cross is indicated. Where in your life suffering comes to you, you should not try to dodge it. You should say, if I have walked into this situation, the best thing for me to do is to enter into it to its greatest depth, and to take out of it whatever lesson there is, which will give me the capacity for understanding all possible situations. So that if I meet a being who's been to hell, I'll be able to talk to him because I've been to hell. Christ goes to hell because he has to complete this educational cycle. If God had come down on earth and done what some of the dualistic thinkers had said he did, namely put a figment on the cross and not suffered at all, then that God would have been deficient in the knowledge of hell. But even in the Old Testament we're told that if we go down into the depths, God is there. God is in hell. If God is infinite, there is nowhere where he is not. If there is hell and God is infinite, God is in hell. Superficial church scholars don't like the idea of God being in hell. But, nevertheless, the great mystics knew that God is in hell. The beings that are in hell are simply beings whose wills, individuated wills, are thwarted. If ever they want to change their mind and give up their individual purpose, in giving it up, they give up the thwartedness and they emerge from hell. The way out of hell is simply abandon your private purpose. Very, very hard to do because the biggest enemy in the universe is inertia. And inertia is the established motion of previous will. People tend to write their names on their works and then to keep at it because they've written their names on them. And this is the cause of inertia, the continuance of faulty purposes. Because people say, I have said I will do it. They write capital I on it and drive all their will into it. And they are feeding it, and that is the inertia, the in working of the will. So, really, there is only one enemy, and this enemy is inertia. There is a release of energy, a committal. And then, because one has released it and declared one's aim, one follows it. That is inertia. Inertia is the established motion of previous will. So when you try to defeat a habit you've got, which you want to get rid of, you're fighting yourself, your own will. Habits are not something from outside. They're something you have committed yourself to. So if you wanted to break one, you would first have to admit that you had created it. You'd have to say why you had created it, why you wrote your name on it, and why you are now prepared to cross your name off it, let go of it, abandon the aim, even publicly, and give it up. And when you give it up, then your will comes back to you. It no longer feeds that form. And the will then becomes unified. And then when you've got your unity of will, you can throw away the form. And when you're absolutely secure, you can let go of the edges of your will. The first thing that ever appeared, that circumscription. And you can afford to dare to be infinite. That is, at that point, you say, this soul, all the energy involved in it, which came in, can dare to go out. And whatever happens to it out there, it could restate itself, if it will. So there's an absolute security about it. There's no necessity for counting, measuring, self-assuring, because you know that you are infinite. Being infinite, if there are any finites, they are internal to the consciousness resident in finites. Your own consciousness has no edges and absolutely transcends all the definitions of all other beings. So no philosophical system or religious system could circumscribe such a being. And nevertheless, it can see the significance of all religions and philosophies and their practical use to finite beings. So it allows everything to exist at its own level and yet asserts its own superiority. So the non-dualist allows that the dualist is correct for the dualist. But the dualist cannot understand the non-dualist. Most people who go to church pray to a God other than themselves. If you say to one of those people who believe they're in good faith, you are really praying to yourself, they could not accept it. They would say, well, then why don't I get the answer to my prayer? The answer is because your self has more sense than that egoic centre from which you pray. You pray for rubbish, your real self won't reply to that. You ask for a decent reward, a decent purpose to be fulfilled, and your high self will fulfil it. But if you ask for rubbish, you are refuting yourself. And most people pray because they are triggered off by an external stimulus. In America, the scientific prayer for a Studebaker or other things. The external situation determines the form of the prayer, but the inner self considers that to be rubbish, so it doesn't reply. Let us take this concept of the circle, meaning any circumscription, whatever. Let us say anything that is circumscribed can be called a monism. Let us say that if we look at the monistic concept as other than ourselves, we've been dualistic. Because we've set up an object, the monistic philosophy or religion, and ourselves as observing it. We have an ob, the monism, and the server. Both of these have a relating factor, represented by the white paper. So we rub them both out, and that's non-dual. So we set up a monistic theory, realize that we've posited it from ourselves as an object, that means subject and object, a dualism. There's a relating factor between the subject and the object, so we rub them both out, and leave that relating factor as a non-dual absolute. Now let's have a look at the monistic theories a little, and then we can rub them out. We've got the three-part man. There's a man with three parts. We let this man have two brothers, so there can be three men, but we won't bother to draw three brothers, we'll just use the same man. One of these brothers is a heart man. He feels things. And he's a monist. He says all his feeling, his thinking, is just the product of feeling. Thinking is feeling precipitating form. So he says, I explain feeling by saying, feeling becomes thinking by simply vibrating and producing little forms. Those forms in consciousness are really the product of feeling. So thinking is just the way that feeling behaves. And of volition, down here, volition is simply feeling mobilized. So we have a monistic theory based on feeling. I put this one first because it's the truest. Feeling is field consciousness. Feeling is the sentiency, the power of consciousness to know its own modifications. When the modifications are considered to be directional, they are called will. When the modifications are considered to be formally circumscribed zones, they are called ideas. So that there is a monism of feeling. It isn't very popular these days, because there are two other stresses on the human being. This is the one we have to develop, the monism of feeling, before we can rub it out and get to the absolute non-dualism, the absolute sentiency. Now, another way, very, very popular these days, is the intellectual way. The man of ideas says, ideas are paramount, form is to think. This is a man with a powerful intellect who says, feeling is simply that of which I am aware when I formulate things with my thinker. And volition is simply the spontaneous release of energies directionally from my thinker. Now you can see that because the thoughts are discrete, that he has the problem of unification of thought. He has many thoughts, and all the ideas have somehow to be held together in a unity if he's to make a monism. So he has to build all his ideas up, ideas here of particulars, of generals, and then a universal idea. And the universal idea must be such that all the derivative generals and particulars can be logically drawn from it. So it requires a lot of work. The work is so great, there's another kind of fellow down here who doesn't want that amount of work, says, I will act on the world. I believe that the world is material. It is easier to do it. We don't bother to think. Improved it. Now, this tendency of the empirical mind is to go on doing things because it cannot inhibit the energies and turn them into the thinker. Denken ist schwer, says the difference. It's hard to think in the a priori sense. So, let us go down to the empiricist. Let us beat on the world and it will beat back at us in reaction and we'll discover something. So, the empirical method is the lowest of all. Which is also the most stupid, because matter breaks up into molecules and they into atoms and so on, until it comes down in the empirical evolution to the statement that matter is fundamentally energy, charges, but energy isn't matter. So the empirical method refutes itself. In the electron microscope, it has reached a level where another instrument, a bit finer, is dealing with non-material. So today, the whole problem of field mechanics as opposed to particular mechanics, particle mechanics, is becoming important. Later, the whole concept of mechanics will depart, and flux of the field, the laws of flux, will become very important. This empirical being is the most stupid of all beings, and he's driven to refute himself simply by hammering his head against the wall. Eventually, the wall and the head break, and daylight comes in. Then, the thinking man, who's generally a little cut off, because all effort cuts you off, discovers that the link factor between any two ideas cannot be another idea, because if we say the word two ideas, we're already dualistic. And we said before, in any dualism, the difference between cannot be essential. Because if there were absolute essential differences, without similarities, there could be no relation. So there must be something identical. So the thinker discovers there is something between the ideas, which is not thought at all. Between every two ideas is something not an idea. That something is a field state, but that's a feeling. So both the empirical method, which refutes itself, and the thinking method, which to its conclusion refutes itself, and it comes back onto the feeling. Now this feeling process is what is meant by able in the body. This thinking process here, turn down and become empirical. Cain. And the raising of Cain is by beating Cain against the material world until he rises up again into the a priori, which is scientifically the mathematics of the world. And then when he reaches the top level of mathematical statement in a philosophy like eventualism, where everything in the universe is simply a psychological event, he's already near to the point where the next step will take him back into the Abel center. Abel will be reborn. When Cain killed Abel, Abel cried for revenge from the blood. Now the nervous system and brain belong to the canine, and the blood belongs to the feeling. And from the feeling there's a continuous cry for revenge against the abuses of the intellect. It means that every time you get an erroneous idea, the blood is thrown into a state of unbalance. It means that you precipitate by erroneous ideas, feelings of disharmony. These make chemicals that are poisonous. that the blood becomes intoxicated by the byproducts of erroneous thinking, and then you feel terrible. And from the blood, the feeling like cries out, get rid of this erroneous idea. Slay me, Cain, and let me be reborn. So we have three types of monism there. A superior kind, which says that this is a field, that by feeling considered as form, we mean thinking, by feeling considered as mobilization directional, we mean willing. There are three systems. We can take all the philosophical systems we like and draw them out of the intellect, like the Platonic views, a priori, or the pragmatic views, popular in America in the last 100 years growing, but derived from the British philosophers Locke and Hobbes, Hume, and the feeling life. And we remember this feeling life is the life we call the Shemitic. This one is the Hamitic, and this a priori rational is the Yafetic. So it is through the line of the Shemites, the Shem means seed, it's the original seed, which is Seimus. The modern German for seed is Same. That's the Saxon word, Seim. That is the same that derives from an identical seed. The seed of all is feeling, the field awareness. That feeling precipitates an idea, and then uses the idea as a guide for a direction of will. But those people that become fascinated by the idea only forget the feeling, and then the idea begins to disintegrate. All people who become intellectual without developing their feeling become schizophrenes. Schizophrenia is simply thinking without retaining the feeling relation between it. And down here, the Ham, you know, the Ham is the only for Egypt, and the Egyptians were famous for their empirical science. We get the word chemistry from the same word. So the Ham boys down here were busy investigating the gross material world. The Yafetic boys, the Greeks, from Helena and Pyrrha, were being a priori intellectual. And the Shems here, avoiding both of those, felt. In their feeling, they were led all over the earth. Abraham comes out of the order of the Chaldees, a city where the Chaldean astronomers had mapped out the whole formal content of the world, and he knew all about it. Rabbinical tradition puts him in the position of advising people, kings and so on Chaldean astrological matters. But his feeling takes him out of that, and he searches. And the path that he follows and the towns he goes through tell you the evolution of Abraham, directed by his feeling. The names of the places he went in the Hebrew give the indicators of the psychology, the bias of feeling that he had in each place. So the Abraham feeling center there spreads out, and he is a nomadic person, feeling. He's not a dweller in the land, he's a sojourner. He stays for a day and he moves on by feeling. Now, that feeling is obviously not acceptable to a civilization because it isn't stable. He may feel like not going to work today. In fact, frequently his lineal descendants feel like not going to work today. So they do something about it to make it so that they can do so. And the finer their feeling, the more they follow this field consciousness, the more, from the point of view of the civilized man, vague are their movements. You can't tell where they're going. Now, outside the macrocosmic logos is a force running about, and the name of the king, Ahasuerus, means this. This is the name of the wandering Jew that in the tradition spat upon the cross of Christ, and because he refused that cross and spat upon it, he was condemned eternally to wander. The cross of Christ is the macrocosmic one, from which the temporal one is copied. The macrocosmic one is the first big boundary, the affirmation of active and passive, which implies hierarchy. The energies outside that biggest of all circles are not circumscribed, and they just wander about. They don't rotate, they just go about, perpetually dodging. And the name of that perpetual dodger is Ahasuerus. Really, this name means, I have spotted that I will be locked up if I go in there, made to work. So he goes away. So that wandering Jew, in tradition, is said to be still living. During the Middle Ages, they used to believe that he was somewhere in Europe, walking about. People used to look about so they could recognize him. But he looked like all the others. He is still wandering, he wanders eternally. Because outside the biggest circumscription there is the infinite. But that equates it with the Godhead. So the Ahasuerus, who refuses the cross, is the very same one that, because he loves the world, puts his son on the cross. Just as Abraham was prepared to kill Isaac. Isaac Esau means acquired power after. Aha, Suerus. This is salvation. This is power. Let me dodge that cross. I've got a son. Put him on. But the idea is a purely logical one, that every circumscription necessarily excludes as well as includes. And the excluding for the biggest circle of all is infinite. And consequently, that infinite is an eternal wandering spiritual force. And this biggest of all finites is the cosmic logos, which is the Son, the only begotten, the monogenes, the one generated. See if we the word they translate as only begotten is there. Now it really means the one generated. They say only begotten. The idea is this biggest of all circles is the one. Generated. Everything inside here isn't really one at all. It's only a part of one. Only this big one is the one, and this inside here isn't one, it's a part. There's no true unity. In the same way, if I draw the sea flat, I can imagine the sea flat, I've seen it flat. And if the wind comes and blows on it, and a wave comes, I can see easily that the waves are possible. The sea still exists, and so do the waves. But I cannot conceive getting a wave without the sea. So the sea is an essential substratum of the wave, but the wave is not essential to the sea. So that wave is four, same as that circle. That which is outside the circle is absolutely essential. But the circle is a four, so it is. So all the form of the universe, every form whatever, the totality of all forms, is absent. Therefore, or Maya, illusion. Ma is the root of measure. Ya is affirmation. Ma and Ya is the same as measurement and affirmation. This is called the great illusion. But Maya is God's play, formal play. It does not deceive God. But it might deceive a little being in the corner there who can only look this way and see sections of it because his eyes are done everything. He did it all around. A nice spherical head with eyes all over it would have a more comprehensive view. Teleological beings tend to have their eyes on the front. Fearful beings. Fearful beings tend to have their eyes on the side. So they can look back at them and face them. We've got them on the front. Show them how perfect they are. So the absolute, signified by the paper, is not one, and it's two. So we put the relation observed and observed, and the link there. And the set, that is the word that. That's one of them. that relation, right? Held a relation between two posits, a continuous principle underneath. We posit all monisms, and because they're isms, which means is substantial, we have them up. What we want is the absolute, which itself generates cause. Cause is initiation of action, and the absolute generates.
Have you transcended what you described as your own field in that?
You've transcended the use of the word own. And you've taken the D off the word field. They are now pure field. The German word Gefühl is better, because there's no Dean. Very, very often in a particular language, you'll find a word that expresses the concept you want better than in another language, because those people were better at it than another people. The Germans are a feeling people. So if they talk about less Gefühl, it's much less determined than the English word feeling, because the English word feeling says, I'm a materialist. There's a hard g, which means earth at the end. So when an Englishman is having feeling g, he's having feeling g about a material commodity. And otherwise he doesn't do it. When he feels, he's searching to feel. When he has a feeling, it is a gross material. The feel of the German is not chopped. And therefore, German metaphysics hasn't got any sharp edges. They're always feeling over the edges. Not feeling, they're always touching the feel over the edges to get at that which is transcendent. So it's in the German philosophers specifically that we find philosophies of transcendence of form. And with the French ones, we get exactly the opposite. Germans propound problems. Almost impossible a solution, and French people profound that are susceptible of an intellectual solution.
All intellectuals, you see.
Well, what you referred to as individual still persists at a formal place. But you are not stressing it. You're not in the same relationship to it. And therefore it cannot bind you. You can even sit on somebody else's chair. And with the back feeling, you can do it. Don't even hit you. It was said a long, long time ago that it requires a man of very, very great courage to be a practical non-dualist. You don't need a lot of courage to be a pluralist. If you're a pluralist, you can be very, very careful about how people feel. That's a natural, spontaneous thing to do. If your pluralism is correct, if it is really correct, when you connect yourself with other beings, you will think of them as other and you will be careful. And if you're a non-dualist, you won't. You don't need a certain amount of courage to be a non-dualist. Remember, Shankara once taught a king non-dualism, and the king thought, I will test him. He says he's a non-dualist, and therefore he doesn't recognize any differences at all. He's always talking about phenomena being non-essential. They had a rather mad elephant in the stockade, so he told his men when Shankara came the next day to release the elephant unless it charged at Shankara. So the next day they released the elephant and it tore straight at Shankara, and Shankara tore straight at the tree. Whereupon the king came out and said to Shankara, what is all this talk about non-dualism and phenomena? And Shankara looked at him and said, you still haven't learned. It is precisely because you are in this state of ignorance that you see phenomenal me, a phenomenal tree. Now, it's not a verbal play. The fact is that the gross material body of Shankara is an eternal configuration, objectified in the time process.
Because the consciousness inside him had transcended that as a blocking factor for him, didn't make his body not exist for other people, didn't make his body not respond in particular situations as a body must. It was simply that he was superior to the reaction. The king didn't gain his point.